Gay Mormon Stories is a production of Mormon Stories and the Open Stories Foundation. To support this podcast, please donate today at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. And thanks for listening.
This is Danny Parkinson, and I'm here today with another installment of Gay Mormon Stories. Today, I have the great privilege of interviewing my friend Kerry Krall. I haven't known Kerry very long, but I've known him long enough to be super impressed with him. My first introduction to Kerry was through Mormon Stories, when he appeared in a podcast after he had written a controversial letter to the editor, and we're going to talk about that. But the Mormon Stories audience is already a little bit familiar with Kerry Krall from this polemic letter to the editor, but he's gone on to do some amazingly great things, and it turns out that his sexual orientation is a little bit relevant to some of the things he's done. And that's why he's an amazing guest for this particular podcast. So, Kerry, why don't you introduce yourself and correct what I might have just misspoken?
Wonderful. It's so great to talk to you again, Dan. Yes, I am Kerry Krall. All of those things sounded correct, except I'm not sure it was so much the nature of my letter that got it all of its attention. I think it was the fact that BYU pulled it after it was written. And to start off the bat, because I know it could be maybe a little confusing on this podcast sometimes, I will go on the record and say that I am an out-of-the-closet, happy, healthy, gay man who was raised in the Mormon church.
Great. And that's one of the types of people we really want to highlight in this podcast, so I really appreciate you coming on. I also want to mention that Kerry has gone on to do a number of great things, but I think his most time-consuming project right now is that he is a medical student at Harvard University, which is probably the most prestigious university of medicine in the country. So he's doing himself great in preparing for a great future. So I'm really proud of him.
I appreciate that.
Yeah. So, Kerry, we're going to do this in Mormon Stories style, and we're going to really just start at the beginning. And most people's Mormon Stories, a lot of them, it starts well before their birth. And so let's kind of start with what your family was like and what your Mormon heritage is.
Wonderful. Okay, so my Mormon heritage, on my mother's side, my family goes back to Hiram Smith through Joseph F. Smith. I get the wonderful opportunity. In the past, I've been able to go to the Joseph F. Smith family reunions in Salt Lake with a lot of big name Mormon celebrities there. I think Elder Ballard spoke at the last one I went to. And my favorite part of this event that I always like to tell my gay friends in Boston is that at this family reunion, when you show up, you get your name tag. It's got your name, and then they're all color-coded by which wife you descend from.
Okay.
So that is, I think, I think it's a wonderful example of how deep my Mormon heritage is on my mother's side. On my father's side, my dad's a convert to the church. His mom actually did join the church. It was one of the last things I did with my priesthood was baptize my grandma, my dad's mom, maybe two or three Thanksgivings ago when I was still a student at BYU.
Uh-huh.
And that grandma's played a really influential role in me coming out. And I think it was the advantage of seeing how I was being treated and how the Mormon church was affecting me through the eyes of a relative outsider, which was what my grandma was.
Okay.
I think that story, the best part of that story is that at one point I was at church with my grandma. It was the next Christmas after I baptized her that Thanksgiving, and the sacrament was coming around and I didn't take it. And she was sitting next to me. I just kind of took the sacrament and passed it on, which was kind of what I was doing at that time. I definitely had a lot of respect and reverence for the sacrament, and I felt like I was unworthy to participate. And my grandma looked at me and she said, well, why didn't you take any? I mean, she wasn't really used to the upbringing of, you know, when you take the sacrament and when you don't. And I told her, you know, I'd really like to, grandma, but I don't think other people here would think I should, is kind of how I answered it. And she just looked at me and she said, well, I'm not taking it either then, and just passed it along. And it was really that moment when I realized how this looked to my grandma. All she saw was her grandson, who she loved, being excluded from a ritual that was meant to bind together that community of believers. And it was really a turning point for me. I think after that point, I didn't ever regularly go to church after that point, till this point. And I think it was kind of this recognition that it wasn't a healthy place for me at that time. I didn't feel respected and equal and part of the community.
And so your grandma was kind of making a silent protest that kind of opened your eyes to what she could see and maybe you weren't seeing yet. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And I don't even know if she recognized the significance of what she was doing. I just think that she saw unequal treatment.
Yeah.
And it was just very clear that her commitment to me was stronger than her commitment to her new religion.
Yeah. Well, that's a nice story and that's a nice introduction. So why don't we start then at how your family came together and how you came into your family in your early childhood and adolescence, and what was your childhood like?
I love talking about my childhood because it was awesome.
Okay.
So my mom and dad got married at BYU. My dad converted to the church at age 18. And I think he had, he was kind of bounced around in his early childhood. He had his father died and his mother remarried, and he lived with another couple for a while growing up. And I think that the Mormon church was a really stable family for him when he was baptized at age 18. He kind of met it through a girlfriend in high school. And I know he lived with his bishop for a little while before he went on his mission. But, you know, by the time he was done with his mission, he'd been a missionary longer than he'd been just a normal member.
Yeah.
And he went off to BYU and married my mom, who was just like a smiling sophomore at BYU. She got married at age 19. They had four children. I'm the third of four. I have an older brother who is a lawyer working for the military in working for the Army in Texas. I have a younger brother who I'm about to see for the first time in 2 years as he's getting done with his LDS mission, which is also in Texas.
Wow.
And I have an older sister who is currently moving from Salt Lake to Los Angeles. She works as a child life specialist at the Children's Hospital, first in Salt Lake and now in Los Angeles.
Okay.
So I'm the third of four. I always was closest with my sister. We would play sister-like games together. And even though I was a boy, I always would be trying out to get into her clubs she had with her friends. She'd be like super exclusive about it and wouldn't let me play with the Barbies, and kind of held that over my head as a way to manipulate me.
She had everything you wanted.
She had everything. She had all the cards.
Yeah.
And all I had was the desire. Luckily, I do have a girl's name, Carrie, and so every once in a while, someone in the extended family would accidentally send me like a girl's toy for Christmas or for my birthday, and I would just be ecstatic. I remember getting a My Little Pony and just playing with that thing like it was laced with some sort of addictive drug. It was all I could do. I couldn't get my hands off of it.
Now, was this worrisome to your parents?
Oh, that's a good question. My mom, in retrospect, has said to me that she was speaking with her mom when I was little, and they'd said to each other, you know, if Carrie ends up being gay, we'll know there's something to the whole genetic born this way type argument.
Okay.
So that's all she's ever said to me. At least I know it was noticed. I don't know if it was worrisome.
Yeah, but that's nice that they were already thinking in that way, that they were questioning in a empathetic way before it even became an issue. So
definitely. And my upbringing in the church was really positive. Up until puberty, I would just loved the church. I remember one of my purest, sweetest memories of my life is just sitting in primary, singing some song. It was probably I Feel My Savior's Love, I think. And just singing that song at the top of my lungs as loud as I could and really feeling it and believing it. And I just remember this sureness that I was going to go to heaven and that my family was going to go to heaven. And it was just this pure joy that I felt about how wonderful that idea was.
Yeah.
It was a really comforting, positive influence, especially pre-puberty for me.
And did you get bothered by your older brother or bullies at school or any experiences like that? If you were sort of having this kind of tendencies as a really young child, I just wonder if it was cause for teasing or not really.
Yeah, so at school, I was okay because I was actually good at sports. I remember it was like a huge difference for
me. Yeah, that does make a difference for a kid.
Yeah, I was not terrible at different sports. You know, some of them I was terrible at, but I was okay. And that made a big difference for me. As far as my older brother goes, I don't think he ever explicitly bullied me because I was effeminate. Just, you know, he was an older brother. He's like this constant. He was a wonderful older brother, but just as awful as every older brother always is, I feel like.
Right, yeah. Okay, so you came out of it without too much scarring anyway.
Exactly.
At least to adolescence, okay.
Well, pre-puberty, things were great. At puberty, I remember things getting hard. Sixth, seventh grade were tough, tough years for me.
How come?
I think it's just the realization that something's different. It just keeps sinking in. It is this haunting, sinking feeling that you are diverging from your peers and you don't know why, I think is how I can make sense of it looking back. But there was just this feeling of panic surrounding sixth and seventh grade and this desperate, desperate need to fit in with people that just naturally obviously had different interests than me. And so I remember like it being so important to buy the correct skater shoes, even though I never skateboarded, in order to fit in with what all the other boys were doing at that time. And like the desperation with which I pursued my first Valentine, like I needed to have a Valentine for Valentine's Day. It was really, really important. And I bought this really expensive necklace with my allowance that I'd saved up for weeks that really was a waste because I don't think she even cared.
So you kind of needed to show that you were interested in having a girlfriend too, like all the other seventh graders are emerging with their first little mini romances, right?
Definitely. Definitely. Felt that. And I think I was attracted to girls. And in hindsight, I think I was attracted to the idea that the girl was attractive. Just recognizing kind of like the social status that certain girls carried and maybe recognizing that they were desirable to the boys that I had desires for.
Yeah, I'm trying to make sense of that in my life because I had the same thing. I was fascinated by these young, emerging girls who were just developing their bodies. And so I was super interested in these girls and I really wanted a girlfriend, but not, you know, to kiss and hug, but to just this idea of having a girlfriend seemed so cool to me. Just absolutely, I dreamed about it for years, but I couldn't make it work, you know, because it didn't come naturally at all, right?
She was like, a hot girlfriend was like the ultimate accessory.
Right.
In a way, I'm ashamed of admitting now, like it's not, those poor girls.
We didn't know what we were doing and
no,
who
I,
does.
No idea. Age.
But you were struggling with feeling different, but were you really identifying what it was that was different?
Let's think. I have the memory of kind of, you know, if people ask me, when did you know you were gay? The memory I can think of is being at the sixth grade dance and seeing one of my friends who I played basketball with. And I remember TLC, No Scrubs, was on. And it's still my favorite song to sing in karaoke whenever I get up there because of this memory. But I just remember looking over and seeing him kind of like dancing to No Scrubs at a terrible sixth grade dance where everyone's just kind of, you know, girls on one wall, boys on another. And I just remember feeling this like electricity, like I just wanted to go up and talk to him. It wasn't really like a super sexual feeling. It was just, I wanted to be around him all the time. It was like, I think of like Twilight, the movie, the book, where the werewolves can just kind of like fixate on someone and they can't let go. And they just,
I didn't see it, but.
Oh, well, I think the audience will get the
most. The audience has.
Where they, I don't remember what it's called, but like you just kind of imprint or mark on someone and then you're obsessed with that. And that was the feeling I had. It was just kind of this like obsession that luckily I think died down, you know, at least 4 years later before we graduated from high school. So that was.
But he was your friend.
Yeah, he was my friend.
Okay.
At least I tell myself that.
You're still friends?
We are.
Cool.
Him last night.
Came to your straight man party.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, that's cool. It's nice to have childhood friends, and it's nice to, you know, you can't go back and replace a childhood friend, so.
Never.
So, but talk about your church experience during those years.
I think like many gay Mormon men and probably lesbian women as well, I was this really spiritual kid. You know, I was always had the leadership callings, and I would get up and bear my testimony all the time, and I would just get up and cry and cry and cry in ways that I can recognize must have been so annoying to certain people in the congregation. I always got positive feedback for it about how spiritual I was. I think I was just had a lot of hurt. And then the big memory I have from those years that was really painful is I remember we would get up very early to go to stake priesthood meetings, and it's like 6 a.m. It was just this atmosphere of me just being in a room full of men. It's always felt oppressive to me. And maybe, I don't know if I can say always at that point. I mean, it was pretty new, but I have always connected better with women. And a room full of men has always been an intimidating place for me to be. And I remember one of the speakers talked about homosexuality as a great evil. And I remember just internalizing that message. I mean, this sounds like this almost sounds like a propaganda pamphlet, but it's really a true experience for me where I remember internalizing it. And I remember we had church started at 8:30, and this meeting ended at 8. And for that half an hour in between, I remember just finding a classroom and turning off the lights. It was pitch dark. It was like one of the ward closets, which is kind of ironic, I guess, in retrospect. And I remember lying down in that closet and just bawling, sobbing uncontrollably, just feeling inconsolable.
Because you knew this applied to you.
Yeah. Yeah, I did. And it was actually recurrent. This meeting would happen every 6 months, and every 6 months after the meeting, regardless of really what was spoken about, this feeling would come back. And I would go back to that same room. And I still remember one year somebody opened that closet, you know, some nice like young women's leader coming to set up her classroom, opened it and saw me just lying on the floor. And we were just both super embarrassed. Like I definitely scared her. She screamed, and I was, I had these tears running down my face. I had to just turn around and hope for the best that she didn't think something terribly weird was going on. I don't know what I would have thought.
Yeah.
But that was just incredibly painful. I remember feeling more and more detached from my young men's group. They were all surfers and raised in Southern California. And it felt like every lesson, they would make analogies or metaphors to surfing. You know, it's like a 3 or 4 faces coming at you. And this is like life and the temptations of Satan. And it just never really clicked with me. I never got the metaphor. So I guess my experience is that church would become, it was this really unhealthy place where I grabbed a lot of my self-esteem. So I think kind of the theme for this period for me with church activity was that I kind of had this really strange dichotomy where I both looked to the church for a huge segment of my self-esteem. Because on one hand, I was getting a lot of positive feedback for being spiritual and, you know, a very good student of the scriptures. I've probably read the Book of Mormon 20 times before my mission. And I had a lot of really positive feedback coming for those things, but it also at the same time was eating away my self-esteem. I was internalizing a lot of feelings of self-loathing and unworthiness. And really, I remember feeling the loss of that feeling very keenly, the feeling that I described, that assurance that I was going to make it, that I was going to go to heaven. That feeling was just snatched away really by puberty and the changes that happened at puberty. I just felt dirty. I felt unclean. And I felt like that feeling of assurity that I would make it just was so distant. And it was a hard thing to mourn as a adolescent.
Yeah. But did this carry over into the rest of your life? Were you having periods of depression Or was this just this background noise that was sort of making you uncomfortable, but you were kind of able to cover all that?
I think the way it was manifest in my life was just how sensitive I was to criticism. I think I had the typical Velvet Rage. I don't know if you've read that book, but it's...
No, I haven't, but I've heard about it, yeah.
Yeah, it's just this idea that when you have this, when you fundamentally don't feel accepted, and this is particularly in the context of being gay and raised in a straight society, that you just seek for validation everywhere in this unending, like almost voraciously, it's all you can focus on. And I know that that is one of the reasons why I got self-esteem from school, from church, and at least early on from playing sports. And those areas, I just really tried to excel. And if I was ever criticized, it would just be devastating to me. I couldn't take negative feedback. I couldn't take, you know, not being picked for the team or not getting the Student of the Month award. It would just felt like this ultimate failure and rejection. And I just think it was, I had this really soft, vulnerable spot.
And you needed to get your self-esteem by excelling in those things. And
definitely.
Might have that a little still, huh?
Definitely possible. I'm not going to admit to it.
But, you know, that's okay. I want you to keep excelling. But what sport were you involved in?
Yeah. Growing up, I played soccer. I was on a club soccer team in Southern California, which is, that's the big deal. That's the traveling soccer team that you get to
make. Okay.
And then I played basketball. I kind of replaced soccer with basketball towards the end of middle school. And in high school, I played basketball.
Okay.
So my junior year, I made the varsity team. And I just decided it was way too much commitment and I needed out. So I quit basketball as soon as I made varsity.
So you didn't actually end up playing the varsity?
Didn't actually make it to play the varsity team. Nope.
Well, that's a social sacrifice. Did it turn out to be that?
It ended up being fantastic because our basketball team was very intense and you got maybe 3 weeks a year off between spring league and summer league and the actual league and then conditioning. And so I was able to do other things. I did youth and government and I joined the choir because we were going to Hawaii and I took more AP classes than I might have had I been on the basketball team. And I just got involved in other things. It was a wonderful change. I was glad I did it.
Okay. So I'm kind of getting the impression that your struggles were internal, that you weren't one of these kids who was ostracized, that you managed to have friends all the time and fit in socially.
Yeah.
You were able to adapt because you had the luck of being good at sports and being probably a good-natured guy. So I'm hearing that you didn't get the oppression necessarily externally from your peers anyway.
Totally. I was very, very lucky, and I think you're picking up on that, to be spared some of the worst things that a lot of LGBT youth go through these days. I will say, you know, people would call someone gay or a fag all the time in high school growing up. But I do feel like, and this could totally just be in my head, that I would get, if someone was going to call me a name, it felt like that was the name they would call me. And I was obviously probably sensitized to it. But I do think I had tendencies about me that made it so certain people at least did target me. I do remember feeling targeted for being gay above and beyond just the regular, you're gay, you're a fag. And it did affect me very deeply. But like you said, I had other things to lean on. So that it wasn't devastating for me.
Were you stressed that the secret might come out or that people might?
Oh, yeah. And my journals from this era are just tragic. I can't even read them. They're so melodramatic, but they're...
So you were writing about that in your journal, about being gay? Were you already...
No, it was always about the secret of my life. I remember finding a Dostoevsky quote that says something like, every good man has secrets that he won't even confess to himself. And that's written in like really big writing with like frills drawn all around it in my journal growing up.
Okay.
It was like the idea that having a secret was, everyone was supposed to have that, and that it's okay to not even admit it to yourself was very attractive to me.
And so really the family, there wasn't family conflict about that. Your adolescence was relatively smooth with your parents. And
okay, so I guess part of where the story's missing is because it's awkward to bring up, but my parents did find certain images on the computer around puberty time that were different than the types of images that, say, my older brother would have looked at around that time.
Okay.
And so this was like a huge, it was a big issue. I think it, as it would be in any home, and particularly in a Mormon home, where I was in a lot of trouble. And I remember feeling intense guilt and shame when my mom brought me into the computer room to kind of really confront me about what was going on. And they did end up taking me to LDS Family Services on a referral from a bishop after I'd met with my bishop for a while. And that by far was the worst experience of probably my life, going to LDS Family Services. And I don't think it's inherently a problem with LDS Family Services. And I understand that they have made a lot of positive changes recently, but I think how my counselor handled the situation, and the fact that he was treading on a minefield, like I just had so many vulnerable spots. It was bound to explode if he was poking around. It was just a terrible, terrible experience.
So your bishop had referred you because you were looking at images on porn, or did he start asking you if you're masturbating or?
Yeah, I mean, I think he probably did ask me the standard screening questions when someone presents with a pornography exposure. But I think it was all through my adolescence when I would go to my bishop to talk about, I was very careful not to be participating in priesthood ordinances or going to the temple if I felt like I'd had any sort of, you know, slip up is how I would call it at the time. And it would mostly revolve around masturbation and pornography. But I would, I just remember that I would always confess to looking at pornography, and it would be treated, you know, seriously, but kind of like, you know, blasé. Like, I think, you know, it wasn't that huge of a deal, but I would never talk about what kind of pornography it was. Wasn't until my freshman year at BYU, I was getting ready to go on a mission.
But just like, so even though your parents had sort of exposed what kind of pornography, that wasn't part of the bishop's interview or the counseling, or was that a focus there?
So the counseling, the initial counseling, it was under the, yes, everyone knew what kind of pornography it was, but under subsequent bishops, when I was growing up throughout my adolescence, that they didn't all necessarily know me, at least, what kind of pornography I was looking at.
This experience with the LDS social services, then, do you care to tell more about what was so negative about that and why did it?
Sure.
Why do you have such terrible memories of it?
Yeah. So I was about 13 years old and I was brought by my parents, and I did not go willingly. It was something I very much felt coerced to do. And it wasn't the feeling like I'm going to get help. It was the feeling like I got caught and I'm being punished. And when I got to the office, I just remember the counselor, all I remember is that he was a young man, probably maybe around age 30. He had me and my parents come into the room, and he never had them leave the room. And I just remember that was such a problem for me because I didn't want to talk about this at all in front of my parents. I was very much had the feeling that I had that I'd hurt my parents, that I had brought something evil into their home, and I was very ashamed of what I had done. And I remember him asking me in front of my parents why I looked at those pictures, and I gave him the answer that I think I'd very much convinced myself of that was true, which was, I said, well, I just want to know what my body's supposed to look like. And I think I believed that in some warped way.
Uh-huh.
And he just said to me, do you really expect us to believe that? Like,
okay.
He gestured to my parents, and
nice sympathetic response.
Yeah. I remember not being able to answer him for a extended period of time. For me, it felt like forever. It might've been 10 seconds, but I remember it as 15 minutes of us almost being catatonic because I think had no answer. And I just remember feeling really the most intense guilt and shame of my life. I always took a lot from Alma the Younger's description of his guilt and pain and being tortured with the fires of hell and, you know, being racked with his sins. That whenever I would read that scripture, I would always go back to that moment to relate to it, because that's kind of how it felt like to me. It was,
yeah. Well, it sounds really abusive to me. I mean, what a terrible setup.
Yeah.
And you do have a lot of meetings like that where he was just,
no, we left that meeting. And I think obviously my parents, they were in the room and they at least noticed that something was traumatic for me, traumatizing. And I just remember telling my mom, like, I can't go back. I told her I felt like I was in hell and I just couldn't do that anymore.
Yeah.
And to her credit, she and my dad never made me go back.
Okay, good.
And they kind of kept this stance of, they wanted to be there for me. I remember my mom would approach me every once in a while when I was sitting alone and would try to bring something up. And I just remember I'd freak out. I just couldn't talk about it. I would really revert. I'd just start yelling at her. And
because she was hinting at talking about the issue of your sexuality.
Yeah. I just couldn't talk about it. It was,
yeah,
it was too shameful for me. I was really, I had a really hard time even addressing the idea.
Well, you're about to say something further then about your, you know, as you got older with the confessing of the porn and the masturbation, the experience, the ecclesiastical interventions.
Yeah.
Do you want to?
I do. I think one of the things that's most interesting for someone in my position was that when I was at BYU and I finally told them what kind of pornography I'd looked at, the tone just immediately shifted. I think growing up, when the idea was that I was looking at just heterosexual pornography, it was taken seriously. It was never just blown off, but the tone was never urgent. It never felt like a huge problem. And I think that was just the recognition that this is part of the track of growing older that some of these bishops had, just kind of at a practical level.
Yeah.
When it was, no, I look at pornography and it's of men, it just, everything shifted. I had immediately had an interview set up with someone in my stake presidency. Everything was put on hold for me when I was at BYU. Getting the Melchizedek priesthood was a really long process that involved a 2-hour interview with my second counselor in the stake presidency, where I still remember him making me say that I had faith that I would be able to overcome my feelings. And I had to say that I felt like I would be able to get over it and get married to a woman. The reason the interview took so long is because I didn't want to say that. I think I was exposed to enough that at that time, that wasn't really the official church position. The church position had recently kind of shifted away from the idea of pushing young gay men towards marriage. And I just kept telling him, like, sure, I could say I believe that that's possible, but I don't necessarily believe that it will happen for me. I don't believe that's promised to me. And he wouldn't take that. That wasn't faith. It had to be a personal faith where I believed it would happen for me. And I think ultimately, whoa, I just kind of resignedly nodded my head when he repeated for the 17th time, like, do you feel like you can overcome this? And then I was able to receive the Melchizedek priesthood. I mean, I was terrified of missing my milestones. I was a freshman at BYU. I really wanted to go on a mission when everyone else was going on a mission. I was a little late in getting the Melchizedek priesthood as opposed to my roommates and people living on my floor. And I felt that as a sense of shame. I mean, I'd always been the spiritual one and very precocious in the church, and I all of a sudden was falling behind.
So let's go back just a little then. You finish up high school, you got to BYU. Do you have more experience to say that about that? Did you have any terrible heartbreaks or other elements that played a role in, or happy times? You don't just have to tell me the heartbreaks.
Yeah. Freshman year at BYU was wonderful. Outside of kind of my struggles with the church, I had great friends. I feel like when you go to BYU as a freshman, it's just like this really bizarre social experiment where you're just thrown into a place where every single person there is kind of identical to you. And I'm and my best friends from BYU, who I still keep in contact today, just happened to be like the first five people that I ended up speaking to on the first day, because it's almost like you could get along with anyone there because we're all so similar.
Did you live in the dorms?
Yes, I was in DT, I think, for the last DT was a thing.
Yeah.
I do remember freshman year, my floor on DT would have no pants Thursday, where everyone would take off their pants and run around in their boxers.
Okay.
And I remember that was always...
I'm all for that.
It was always a problem for me. I always tried to like stay kind of hidden. But my roommate was just this really great, fun, but super Mormon at the time, young man. And he was not a fan of No Pants Thursday. He was very shy. And they would come into our room and just like literally pull his pants off of him. Like five or six guys, because he wasn't participating. And that was just one of those things. That was one of those experiences.
A little hazing going on.
Like, I was just so glad I wasn't being targeted.
Yeah.
So No Pants Thursday was both like a highlight and a low light, I guess, on freshman year. I do remember meeting a group of older students at BYU that Ashley Sanders, I think, has been interviewed on Mormon Stories, the main podcast, before. And she was kind of this free thinker activist of BYU campus at that time. And I was not in her generation. We just overlapped barely. We would go to her house and she would have these very elaborate discussions where she would have people come in who had all sorts of life experiences that were exotic and romantic to a freshman BYU student. It was really life-changing for me.
She was what, into progressive causes, amnesty, you said?
Yes. She did all sorts of protests at BYU. I remember that year there was an issue with a BYU employee who had been fired for criticizing the BYUSA elections. And as a protest, she organized, we all went up to campus and drew chalk circles around ourselves in honor of Carl G. Mazur's pledge that he could draw a chalk circle around himself and pledge his word of honor that he would never leave it. The power of his word was more strong than if you had erected prison walls all around him, that he would stay in that circle no matter what. And so we all drew chalk circles around us and said that we wouldn't leave our circle until, I don't even know what the outcome we were looking for was, but it was a protest.
Okay. And this was your freshman year.
Yeah, and it was...
So you got plugged into that. Were you also plugged into honors program and other things for the more...
The honors classes I took were just kind of like better taught, a little easier, actually, I think. And they had a budget for like pizza nights every once in a while.
Big, big bonus.
Yeah. So I feel like that's all really the honors program was to me. I'm sure I'm selling it way short and probably offending someone, but that was just my experience of it.
But you were getting exposure. Was that where you were meeting these people that were having an influence on you, maybe politically? And
I met them at Amnesty. I joined the BYU's Amnesty International chapter. And through that is where I met a lot of these kids.
So you joined the Amnesty chapter. So you had some sort of progressive bone going on as a freshman already, huh?
Yeah. My mom was always the one Democrat in our ward growing up. And she has had a great influence on me, I think, politically. The other big event, I guess, from freshman year at BYU that's worth mentioning is it was the first year that Soul Force came to campus, which is the Christian LGBT group founded by Mel White, who I know he used to be a conservative speechwriter for like George Bush, and he founded this organization that goes around to college campuses that discriminate against LGBT students. Explicitly, they go a lot to military schools and to religious schools, and they bring young LGBT kids who come and stage on-campus protests.
Okay.
They did that at BYU while I was a freshman, and I just remember being transfixed. I showed up to their rally by myself. It was at Kiwanis Park, and it was not very well attended, and I remember a car driving by and yelling faggots at us. Which wasn't, you know, the best thing, but it just almost felt like it added to the urgency of the meeting.
Yeah.
But through that group of kids that I had those discussion nights with, they invited them over for a family home evening. They invited the LGBT students who were visiting campus.
Oh, really?
And it was really my first time talking to someone who was openly LGBT.
Okay.
Trans man there, and there was a lesbian girl who was very kind to me and kind of took me under her wing. I think they all saw right through me and my whole, like, oh, I'm just very interested in your cause. I'm not gay, but, you know, that.
Yeah.
Oh, I went to the BYU bookstore and I bought Ty Mansfield's book, In Quiet Desperation, and I gave it to Mel White, the man who ran the organization, and just kind of with a note that said, in case you were wondering, this is one of the most current resources that we have about how the LDS Church makes a place for its LGBT members. And at the time, I think I was definitely endorsing the book as like having a really legitimate, viable solution to the gay problem.
And you had read the book?
I'd read it.
Okay.
And I put my email address in it. And I remember getting an email from Mel where he kind of just said, look, I really need to talk to you. I think that you're in trouble, basically. I don't think he used those words, but I remember I just couldn't respond. It felt like I was about to go on my mission, and I just definitely labeled it as this is a temptation of Satan trying to distract me from my goal of going on a mission.
Yeah.
And I responded to him, and I would actually really like to. This reminded me, I want to look him up. Those were my big formative experiences, I think, freshman year at BYU.
Okay. Okay, so you finished your freshman year. You were going directly on a mission. You managed to get your Melchizedek priesthood by the skin of your teeth. Let's keep going then. The mission years.
Yeah, I went to South Carolina, which it was one of those things where I was in DT and everyone opened their mission calls together. I remember the same day I was called, you know, someone was called to Russia and someone to Haiti and all these exotic places. And then I got South Carolina. And although I acted like I was so excited, I was a little disappointed.
Well, between you and me, I think of South Carolina as being pretty exotic. But
yeah,
I guess I can relate to, you know, wanting to go to some foreign land with a foreign language.
Exactly.
I definitely wanted that.
Yeah. So where did you end up going?
I went to Montreal.
That's right. That's okay. That makes sense now. Well, yeah. So South Carolina ended up actually being a phenomenal place to serve a mission, because if you're going to talk about Jesus for 2 years, you might as well do it in the rural South,
where they're obsessed.
Exactly. I had a fantastic mission. I remember early on in my mission, you know, I had a lot of doubts about the church that had built up, although never in a way that sincerely and strongly challenged my testimony. I always felt like I had a testimony prior to my mission. So some of these doubts were about the church, and some of these were just about myself and my ability to conform. But I remember very early on in my mission deciding I was going to put that all aside, recognizing that I wanted to be happy for the next few years. I needed to fully buy in to what was ahead of me on my mission. And so that's what I did. And I had a very successful mission and rose up through leadership, became an assistant to the president, and really enjoyed. I think what I loved most about being in leadership in my mission was that I was being looked up to by Mormon men, my peers. I was just intoxicated by that status.
Uh-huh.
And feeling like, oh, I obviously was, like, if all of these good Mormon men who were going to make it looked up to me, then of course I was going to make it. And I think since my mission, as I've gone through my coming out process, by far the hardest people to come out to, and kind of the idea of these people has kept me, you know, in my partial closet for a long time, was my mission companions and other people that I met on my mission.
Okay.
Because it was a time when I acted like everything was okay, and I paid the price for it when I realized it wasn't, and that it wasn't going to be. And so it was just this time that I feel really sensitive to the idea that I was being hypocritical in ways. I wasn't being authentic and true.
But you weren't feeling that then, or that wasn't in the forefront of your mind then? You weren't, were you suffering with that, or?
No, I bought in. I was, the only blips of my mission is every once in a while you'd have companions who love to wrestle, or you'd have like little moments that would just kind of jar me back to, okay, something is different and wrong. Besides that, it was.
So it wasn't too troublesome. I really enjoyed my mission. I enjoyed the camaraderie and I enjoyed the intimacy I had in our friendships. And it was nice. And there was a gay sort of background to it, but I wasn't super going there with my thought process most of the time.
Definitely.
But were you finding that? Were you having a lot of those experiences at the MTC or just where the intense one-to-one bonding was?
Yeah, I think
was getting uncomfortable or.
Yeah, I think
too compelling.
Yeah, I think I can think back to an experience of getting transferred away from a longtime companion and just really being depressed for about a week and not really being able to put my finger on it. But having gone through breakups since then, I realized it was just my first breakup I was feeling. I was romantically attached to this companion, and the idea of being just kind of sent away, put away like a shameful ex-lover was just too much. It was hard. It was one of those things where you just wanted to call or find a way to make contact. And, but it was okay. I mean, I got through it, but it definitely, I was feeling a breakup and I was totally lying to myself. And it's kind of sad that my first breakup was with someone that was obviously never going out with me, but that's kind of how I feel about it, at least in my own experience of waking up.
I can believe that.
That sounded like an insult.
No, it's just, it makes sense. And I had, there's a certain amount of sublimation that gay people do in that situation. And I did that a lot. I had some amazing friendships with different elders. And afterwards, I had my best friend at BYU, and he's a great person. We're still friends with these days. But obviously, my sexual orientation was playing a role in our dynamic. And even though I, didn't generally spend a lot of time lusting after any of these guys physically, I did lust after the emotional attachment. Mm-hmm. And I would get really jealous I felt neglected as a friend, and I would, it was a strain on the friendship. And, to their credit, my super friend, really was able to put it all in perspective, and we managed to maintain our friendship through some really hard times we both had, me coming out and him being sort of the punching bag sometimes with me in that process and him going through his own stuff. So. Anyway,
yes. I think you nailed it. That's exactly the type of feelings I had.
But it sounds like you were on the outside a successful missionary. You came home, with the right credentials. You got what people wanted. You were the AP, and so you have a skill that you managed to find success whatever you do, regardless of what it is. So. I'm glad you're turning that to good things.
Oh, thank you. I think missions I was particularly good at just dealing with people and reading people. I think all my life it had been important for me to pick up on social cues and to recognize when to push people and when to lay back and be that really just supportive influence that was kind of just manipulating things behind the scenes. Without being aggressive. And I think that really paid off on my mission. I think I was often liked by other missionaries and my companions. I mean, I'm sure I annoyed them at some level. By far the hardest thing of a mission is just not being able to be alone forever. But it was maybe a lot of my success had to do with lessons I learned early being a closeted gay man.
Did it give you extra empathy, do you think?
I do think so. I think that it gave me empathy for people. You know, I think oftentimes with missionaries, when someone fails to keep commitments or, you know, drops you as missionaries, there's a tendency when you're not in your super spiritual mode to like get angry at that person and blame them and talk about all of their problems that led them away. But I just definitely had this place where I could understand how the program wouldn't fully work for someone else. And it was seldom my impulse to blame an investigator for not becoming a Mormon.
Yeah. So you finished your 2 years, you came back to BYU.
Mm-hmm.
So
started dating.
Started doing creative dating, I imagine, because that's what gays are so good at, right?
Yeah, definitely. Did the whole, like, let's go to the library and pick out our favorite children's books and read them to each other. And just like all sorts of painful memories of little creative dates I set up. But
you were buying into the idea that you needed to go get married? Was this just a survival technique, or was it that you were really actually pursuing trying to get a relationship going?
I wasn't desperate to get married. I was desperate as a scientist almost to just gain more experience.
Okay.
To gather data. I mean, I just had never, all through high school, I never had any romantic encounter. I mean, I went to dances. I was always the safe Mormon date and also the safe gay date, you know, just not explicitly so. I just think I was inherently non-threatening.
And yeah.
I would always be like the guy next door to go to. I went to 6 different proms and I only asked a girl to one. So I was okay. Asked 5 different proms.
Sadie Hawkins thing.
Exactly.
Well. Yeah.
And so for me, I wanted to know if I could date girls and if it would be exciting and if I would enjoy it. And that's what I was going about doing. I was going on 2 or 3 dates a week.
And was it exciting? Was there some element? Did you explore physicality at all? Or
It's just, I think what I could say, so I did have one very serious relationship while at BYU. And up until that point, though, going on dates was just too much effort for limited returns. Like, I loved the girls and they were very good friends. But, you know, a straight man planning dates for a girl has like that excitement of physicality to keep him moving forward. And
yeah.
For me, it was so easy to lose interest. It was just boring. There was nothing at stake when I went out. I was not pushing myself. There was no adrenaline.
There was no prize to have the eye on either.
Exactly. And none of these girls, I think what changed, because I did have about a year and a half long relationship with a wonderful girl while I was at BYU. And what was different about that relationship that made it intimate and personal and important to me was the fact that before we, you know, started dating, I let her know my situation. We drove to Kiwanis Park. And that same park where I'd gone to the rally a few years ago with the Soul Force group. And we were sitting in the car and I was once again very melodramatic in hindsight. But I said, you know, your life's either going to become much easier or much more complicated after tonight because I'm not like most other Mormon boys. I am attracted to men. And I remember saying that and bawling. And she just looked at me and said, that's okay. I like hanging out with you. Let's keep this going. And then that night, I had my first kiss in Kiwanis Park. And I'm sure I was terrible at it. It was a very special moment for me because it was the first moment in my life I told someone I was gay who wasn't a priesthood leader and who responded with acceptance.
Uh-huh.
It didn't bother her. And she just kind of, it was the first time somebody knew the secret of my life that had terrified me. And they acted like it was just nothing. And it was okay. That level of acceptance is It was probably one of the most influential things to ever happen to me in my life. And I still am always going to be grateful to that girl for responding the way she did. I mean, she was an Idaho girl. There's no reason to think she would be particularly progressive, or besides she was an English major, and they tend to, you know, be a little more progressive than others.
They're slightly more left.
Yes. But she was fantastic, and we had a wonderful relationship. I mean, really, we were best friends, and we would get physical. We would make out with each other, and I would end up enjoying it. But I know to get started, I would just have to tell myself, I convinced myself that this was like a love language problem, that my love language just wasn't physicality, but hers was. And so by making out with her, I was telling her how much I loved her in her own language. Is
yeah.
kind of like the mental game I played.
And you did love her.
I definitely did love her. And she meant just so much to me.
Thank you for joining us today on Gay Mormon Stories. To discuss this episode with others, please check us out at gaymormonstories.org. If you want to see this podcast continue, please consider making a monthly donation, again at gaymormonstories.org. All donations go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer Mormons. Music for this podcast was donated by George Parkinson and Kelly Clark Parkinson.